Dr. Kruger!
When you're old like Matt, you've been here for 10 years. You did ask lots of questions. Some you can answer and some you cannot. So you go and ask your friend. Here's 10 hard questions for 10 good friends. So sit back, relax, and listen. Cause now it begins.
All right, y'all, welcome to the first podcast thing of me reflecting on the 10 hardest questions that I've received in doing 10 years of working for RUF. And we're going to kick it off today with the question of canon. Now, if that's a weird word for you, if that's weird language for you, the question of canon is really the question of how do we know that we have the right books in the Bible? Ultimately, the question underneath that is, how can you trust the Bible? Is it reliable? What if there are books out there that should have been included in the Bible and they aren't? And what if there are books, you know, inside of our current Bible that should have made the cut? Get those things out of there. How do we trust the Bible? How do we know that this is the book that we are, quote, supposed to have? So that's the question on the table. I've been asked this question recently. This is a question that has popped up periodically throughout the decade, I should say. And to help answer this question, I recruited a bit of a scholar, you might say. And by a bit of a scholar, he's a legitimate scholar. This is one of my old seminary professors, Dr. Michael Kruger. He is a professor of New Testament and early Christianity at RTS in Charlotte. That is Reformed Theological Seminary, which is where I attended seminary at Charlotte, North Carolina. He's also an ordained minister in the PCA, the Presbyterian Church in America. He's an associate pastor at his home church, Uptown. Great man, brilliant man, done a ton of work in this area. He's written books about it. He's got articles about it. He's got a blog kind of devoted to this whole question, which we'll get into in our conversation. But rather than me just go on and on sitting here in my office, I want you to listen to this phone call that I had with Dr. Kruger. And a little disclaimer, by the way, heads up, you should know, you know, we're not This American Life around here. We don't have fancy high-tech sound equipment. So my phone call with him, I just basically recorded on my little computer here. So it's, you might say it's not the highest quality, but I would also like to add it's not the lowest quality. So here we go. I guess maybe the best way to begin is by defining the questions surrounding what the canon is. Like for me, when I think of what a canon question typically is, I think, how do we know that we have the right books in the Bible? Would you say that's the question? Are there kind of like a nest of questions around what the canon, quote, canon question is?
Yeah, I think that is the question, but I think there's also a nest of questions. So I think the only reason that we have a conversation like this in our world is because of the unique nature of Scripture as a book that's really a bunch of little books, right? So if the Bible was one book written by one author at one time, you know, we wouldn't be having this conversation. But given that you got a bunch of little books written over a long period of time by a bunch of different authors in different places, then suddenly there's this question of collecting them. You know, who did that and when did it happen and why these books and not others? So those are really distinctive questions that really Christians and really only Christians have to answer because of the distinctive nature of Scripture.
Yeah.
And so, you know, our question is a natural one, which is, well, why is it this book and not that book? And, you know, there's corollary questions. You know, you asked it in terms of how do we know we have the right books, which is, I think, the nub of the issue. But there's also just practical questions. Some people just want to know how it happened, right? Like, well, when did it take place? And what historical events are the key events, and you know what is the process and major players in terms of these decisions? So some of it's historical, and some of it's, you know, more theological.
Yeah, and I'm just curious for you personally, how long have you been studying this subject and been interested in this particular field?
Yeah, so my interest in canon began as an undergraduate student, so this may be something that your students can relate to. I did my studies at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and when I was a freshman, I had a New Testament intro class with what is now the very famous professor, Bart Ehrman. And Ehrman, you know, is known for his critiques of the New Testament and the New Testament canon. And so when I had him as a professor, it raised all kinds of issues in my mind about whether the New Testament was reliable, whether these were the right books, how we know, how did it all happen. And so I started my journey as a student, and that eventually led to go to seminary and then eventually PhD work and beyond. So it's been a question on my mind for a long time. But the longer I study it, the more I realize, though, that this is a very common issue. It's not something that just a few elite scholars deal with. I mean, this is a very widespread issue amongst all Christians of all stripes, because everybody eventually, if they think about it, ends up asking that question.
Yeah.
And it needs an answer.
Yeah. And so for me, this question made my top 10 list of the most challenging questions I've been asked in 10 years. I'm curious. I know I'm not asking you to come up with your top 10 right now, but do you think this question would make your top 10 list of maybe the most challenging questions that you've interacted with?
It certainly makes my top 10 list of the most common questions.
Gotcha.
And I certainly think it's got its challenging dimensions to it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I would say it's the most challenging kinds of questions that we get as Christians.
Yeah.
But it's certainly up there. What I'm always encouraged by is that I think there's really good answers to the questions about canon.
Yeah.
And we're in a really good position as believers to answer those questions. So in that sense, I think it's an encouraging set of questions to ask.
Hmm.
And I think that's helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. And why do you think it's important for Christians to be able to know how to answer this question?
Well, part of the reason why I think it's important is just by virtue of the fact that everybody, not everybody, but at least many Christians will find themselves asking it themselves and will be asked a lot of these questions by the culture.
Yeah.
So, again, it's not an ivory tower issue where you only deal with this if you're tucked away in the deep parts of scholarship. It's sort of every believer at some level is going to come across it. And a good example of this is just the way the media works. So whenever there's a new gospel discovered, you know, it hits the media and you hear about it, and you're like, well, why is that gospel not in the Bible, and why are my gospels in the Bible?
Yeah.
We might read an article on a website or in a magazine that on Easter or Christmas challenging the books we have and the accounts in the books we have. And those are all the kind of things people will eventually come across. So I just think it's an inevitable question. It's a question you can't really hide from.
Yeah.
And if you're going to witness to non-Christians, you've got to have at least some basic answers, because they're going to want to know what makes this Bible thing so unique. If it's just a bunch of smaller books written by people all over the place, why should I think these books are anything special?
Yes. Yeah, and how do we know that we have the right amount? Like, why? How do we know they're not supposed to be more or less? And yeah.
Correct.
And obviously, I want to hear your answers to a lot of these questions. My personal challenge has been, when students ask me this question over coffee, for me, it's hard to give a succinct answer, because it's just such a massive question. I mean, even if you think about, like, you taught a whole seminary class over this. You've written tons about it, you know, big books about it. So I'm just curious, is there a way to provide a succinct and satisfying answer to these questions, or do you really just need, like, 6 hours with somebody to unpack everything?
Well, it depends on the level of questions they have. I think you're right. It's a very complicated issue. There's a lot of layers to it, and you feel like, where do I even begin? Because as soon as I say one thing, there's 10 other things I'm not saying and I can't say in one conversation. So you feel sort of paralyzed by the complexity of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of things are that way. So, you know, what I typically do is start off with some basic sort of narrowed down questions. So one thing I typically do to help narrow things down is I say, okay, let's just talk about the four Gospels for a moment, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You know, there's all these canon questions, Old Testament, New Testament, the whole, you know, all these different things. But let's just talk about these four Gospels. Do we have any reason to think these are the right four Gospels? That the early church, you know, settled on the best four, so to speak. And I think that is a way you can sort of narrow the issue down so people can grasp and understand.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can talk about other books too, but I think the evidence for the four Gospels is really impressive evidence. And in that sense, I think that's a good place to start.
Yeah. So, okay, I want to get into a little bit and hear what your specific answers are to some of these questions. So if we just start with maybe the biggie of how do we know we have the right books in the Bible? Who gets to decide that? What's your you don't have to give your elevator pitch answer. You can answer this as long as you want. But how do you answer that question when you're asked, how do we know we have the right books?
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of ways to slice that up. You could ask it from a number of different angles. One way we could say, if I'm wondering whether we have the right books, I could ask the question, well, what were the books that the earliest Christians were reading? In other words, the earliest believers that we can see after Christ, the earliest believers in the church, what books had they seem to think were the ones that were coming from the apostles and gave authentic testimony to Jesus? That's at least a relevant question and a pretty important one, I would think.
Yeah.
And so you can at least start there. You can say, look, one of the reasons why we think these are the right books is because when you look at the earliest Christians, they rallied around these books from a very early time. There seemed to be an emerging consensus that these were the books that were the ones that went back to the time of Jesus, went back to the apostles, went back to the first century, and give us an accurate picture of the type of things that we are asking, or questions we're asking. So I think the testimony of the earliest Christians is a great place to look. You know, that should hold significant weight for us in terms of why we think the books we have now are reliable.
Yeah.
Another thing I would say is, in terms of how we know we have the right books, is sort of, where they came from. In other words, part of what makes a book a quote right book is does the author have any reason, or do I have any reason to think the author is going to be delivering authentic content? In other words, is he writing at a time period where he could know such things? Has he been given a particular task by Jesus to speak for Jesus? These are important questions, and I've argued in the numerous books I've written on this topic that I think all the New Testament books have what we would call apostolic credentials, which means they all, I think, have a reasonable sort of claim to contain apostolic teaching, which means that when we read the New Testament, we're not just reading random guys. We're reading what Jesus' closest associates and the ones he commissioned to speak for him were saying. And I think those are very good reasons to think the books that we have are the best ones.
So which books the early church were interacting with and which ones they were seeing as authoritative, as well as the apostolic connection? Are those the two big points in your mind?
Yeah, well, there's even more to say beyond that, but I would at least start there with most people in a conversation.
Yes.
And say, let's at least talk with about those two points. Now, if you take those two points and you just start with the four Gospels, I think you can make a pretty good case really quickly. So, for example, let's look at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and ask the question, which Gospels were the earliest church, was the earliest church reading? Which Gospels were they most interested in? Which Gospels did they copy the most and read the most and sort of talk about the most? And there's tremendous evidence that it was Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Yeah.
And they were quite settled on those Gospels quite early. It wasn't the Gospel of Thomas, despite all the love for it in the modern media. It wasn't the Gospel of Philip or the Gospel of Mary or the Gospel of Truth or the Gospel of Judas or any of the other Gospels. It was Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So if you take that first question, what were the early church, what books were the early church gravitating towards? The Gospels win in spades.
Yeah.
And then take the second question about apostolicity. Which Gospels do we have give us the best chance of getting material that came from apostles, that came from Jesus' best friends, so to speak?
Yeah.
Well, once again, the Gospel of Thomas doesn't do it. The Gospel of Philip doesn't do it. The Gospel of Peter doesn't do it, because all those Gospels were written in the second century or later. They're late after the fact Gospels. There's no way they could have been written by a follower of Jesus. But Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are all dated to the first century, and at least they have a good shot of being written by the followers of Jesus, or at least by their companions in the case of Mark and Luke. And there's many more layers of evidence we could go into for why we think those books go back to the earliest followers of Jesus. But here's the point, is that if you're going to have a shot, even a shot of getting back to the earliest followers of Jesus, you're not going to pick the Gospel of Thomas. You're not going to pick the Gospel of Peter. I mean, your best shot are these four.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about some of these other Gospels, Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Peter, these things that, make these splashy headlines that kind of, in some ways, it seems like they're posted or they're getting all of this attention in such a way to discredit the reliability of the Bible. So if like, what would be your kind of bullet point response to why these are not authentic, why these should not be in our in the canon. You said because they're not first century documents.
Well, yeah. So first bullet point is they're all late.
Yeah.
And by late, what I mean is they're second century or later, and some much later. Hmm. If someone says, "I want a gospel written in the first century," and which would make sense, right? Because Jesus and the apostles lived in the first century, and you want to be as close to them as possible. If someone said, "I want a gospel from the first century," then there's only four options: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So the first problem with the apocryphal gospels is they're all late, and therefore, whatever name is attached to them, those are not their authors.
Yeah.
Because we know they were written well after the apostles lived. That's the first problem with these gospels. Mm. But there's other things about them that I think are highly problematic. A second thing about them is the way the early church viewed them. They were largely rejected and condemned by most early church writers. Mm. Even the ones that seemed fairly neutral were not used very much. So what you have with these apocryphal gospels is, I think, a large either neglect or condemnation for the most part. Mm. So they don't seem to have a lot of real standing in the church. Yeah. A third bullet point would be that almost all the apocryphal gospels are clearly dependent on the canonical four. Hmm. Without exception, we can hardly find an exception to this, where they're clearly drawing from, even in some cases, clearly copying from, and dependent on Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Yeah.
And so they're clearly late, derivative, after the fact gospels. And then the last thing I would say about them is that they often, not always, but often contain very heretical and strange, bizarre content that does not fit with any other things going on within the Orthodox stream of early Christianity, and things that are clearly attached to fringe groups, Gnostic groups, Valentinian groups, and so on.
So
those are four good reasons right there to think that those apocryphal gospels don't have any real claim on authenticity.
If I'm remembering right, was it the Gospel of Peter, which you said that, like, when Jesus is resurrected, he's like a giant or something?
Yeah. The Gospel of Peter is a great example of the kind of things you get in these apocryphal gospels, because the Gospel of Peter shows you a live action shot of the resurrection, so to speak, where Jesus is actually coming out of the tomb. Which is curious to note, because none of the four gospels do that, right?
Yeah.
The four canonical ones. They are all very restrained. They just show you the tomb after Jesus is already gone. But Peter decides he's going to fill in the gaps, which is common in apocryphal gospels. He's going to show you Jesus rising from the dead, but when he does, Jesus doesn't have a normal body. He's giant Jesus. His head touches the clouds. It's really a strange, bizarre picture of the resurrection.
Yeah, that is weird. So, you know, there's I guess a common narrative out there is that it wasn't until the 4th century that the church decided, okay, this is what's going to make the cut for the New Testament. This is what's in. This is what's out. What's your response to kind of that narrative?
Yeah, well, first I would say that that is a common narrative that's out there. It gets circulated to all kinds of places, certainly in popular literature, on the internet, but even in some scholarship, unfortunately. But I think the narrative misses a lot of key points. And the major point it misses is that we have great historical evidence that there was a core collection of New Testament books operating as a canon as early as the middle of the 2nd century. Hmm. And by core, what I mean is 21, 22 out of 27 books were pretty well established by the middle of the 2nd century. Now, there was some ongoing discussion on some of the smaller, what we might call fringe books, sort of 2nd Peter, 2nd, 3rd John, James, and so on. And, you know, those conversations continued on for a couple generations and were fully resolved somewhere around the 4th century.
Yeah.
But if you say that you don't have a canon of the 4th century, that's not really accurate, because it wasn't like it was a completely up-in-the-air enterprise until the 4th century. It wasn't as if Christians were going around saying, wow, well, for the last 300-plus years, we don't know what to read, and thankfully, finally, someone's told us, or something like this. That's not what happened. Yeah. What you have is evidence that Christians were coalescing around a core very, very early, so it seems they did know what to read for the most part, and for the most part, there was no ambiguity about the core. Hmm. It was only a couple of the smaller books that were most of the discussions were about. So it's just misleading for people to talk about 4th century as the first time we have a canon, when that's not really quite the whole story.
Hmm. Gotcha. So let's talk about the Bible being self-authenticating for a second. This is a term you use. I like it. We both sign off on this. Can you describe what do we mean by when we say that the Bible is self-authenticating, and how does that? Why is that not a circular argument for how we establish what the Bible is?
Yeah, well, now you opened up a whole big area of discussion, so yeah, happy to...
I told you it's a challenging question.
Quick bullet points.
Yeah.
Yeah, so most of the time when we believe things, we think we believe them and can only believe them based on some other external authority. That's how we normally operate.
Yeah.
So if I want to believe that something is true, I don't believe it's true unless I have an external validating authority that tells me it's true. And for the most part, that's an sort of an epistemology that works for most of us in our lives, but it runs into a problem when you get to ultimate authorities.
Hmm.
Ultimate authorities can't be validated by another external authority, because if you did validate it by that other external authority, then it's no longer an ultimate authority because you need something else to validate it.
Hmm.
So when it comes to the ultimate standards for what we know, they're by definition dependent on themselves. You can't go outside of them, because as soon as you do, you've just proven they're not really ultimate. And so the problem with most of our reasoning is it takes place at approximate level and not it doesn't really deal with ultimate authorities. People aren't used to trying to validate an ultimate authority.
Yeah.
But we think the Bible is an ultimate authority because it's God's own words. And so how does God validate himself? Well, God doesn't say, well, you should believe me because of some other guy says I'm a good fella. God is inherently self-validating. And we see this in Scripture, right? When we swear an oath in our lives, we swear based on some other higher authority. But when God swears an oath, he swears on himself.
Yeah.
And so there's an inherent sense in which that's circular, okay, but not fallaciously circular, not circular in a problematic sense, but just inevitably circular. Of course it's circular, because God's God. What other thing is he going to appeal to?
Yeah.
Now, when you take that understanding and talk about how we validate the Bible, this is why theologians, including myself, believe that at the end of the day, the Bible is self-authenticating, which means it can demonstrate its own authority, that we should receive its authority based on its own qualities and its own attributes. It doesn't mean that historical investigation's irrelevant. It just means that there's things about the Bible that show that the Bible is from God. We don't need to go outside the Bible to learn those things. And this is why theologians have often described the Bible as having what we call divine qualities. Now, this is a larger discussion than we can open up here, but divine qualities are basically saying that the Bible has certain attributes about it that show us it's from God, and the attributes that it has are God's own attributes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So an example of a divine quality would be the remarkable unity and harmony of the Bible within all its constituent parts. That reflects God's own character, because God is harmonious, and he doesn't lie, doesn't contradict himself, and so we would expect that to be true of the Bible. And there's many other internal qualities we could jump into, but these are the kinds of things that we think are important as a consideration, too, that we don't just validate the canon because the apostles are the author of these books. We also can validate the canon from what's in it, the content itself.
Yeah, that's helpful. Okay, I don't know how to pronounce this word, but I think it's important to this discussion. Muratorian fragment? Muratorian?
Yeah, that's right. You did it right.
Is
Muratorian,
that,
yep.
Muratorian?
Yeah.
It's been a few years since I've said this word. Okay, so can you explain what the Muratorian fragment is and why it's important in these conversations?
Very good. So one of the questions that comes up when you discuss canon was, or is, what's our earliest list that somebody made in the early church of which books are in the canon? So what's our earliest canonical list? And that happens to be found on a certain fragment of a list called the Muratorian fragment, and it's our earliest list dated to probably about 180 AD, so very, very early. And so people need to know what that is just by virtue of the fact that it's our earliest canonical list, but why it's important is because of what's in there. And what's in there is it shows that what I said a moment ago, which is that you have a core canon already in place by the second century, and what the Muratorian fragment affirms is about 22 out of 27 books, which is really remarkable. So it affirms the four Gospels, Acts, the 13 letters of Paul, 1 Peter, 1 John, Revelation, and so on, whatever ends up giving you to 22. It's a remarkable document for that reason. And what it does show is that there was a remarkable amount of unity around these core books from a very early time.
Wow. Yeah, which plays into what you were saying earlier about the 4th century kind of common narrative, and it kind of blows that up in some ways.
It does. It blows it up. It says that, look, it's true in one sense that the 4th century is the time when things settle down, if by that one means that all the peripheral books are kind of finalized, but the 4th century is not the proper date when you ask about when we start seeing books used in Scripture. That happened much, much earlier.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, can we talk text criticism for a minute? This is a big area that you're into. Can you say what it is? What is text criticism, and how does that field of study play into the kind of canon question?
Yeah, so they're corollary questions. They're different questions. So the canon question is which books, mm-hmm. and textual criticism is asking the question of which text or which words in these books.
Hmm.
So the field of textual criticism exists because in the ancient world, when you would publish a book and then distribute a book, you didn't just go down to the printing press and run off copies because there was no printing press. You had to make copies by hand, and then the people who received that copy would make a copy of that copy by hand, and then that copy would be copied by hand, and on it would go.
Yeah.
And in the ancient world, that was the way you did it. And when that happened, scribes make mistakes. Sometimes they were good scribes. Sometimes they were lousy scribes. Sometimes even good scribes made mistakes where they left out a word or misspelled a word or they flipped the word order around or they were just half asleep or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah.
And so you have what are called scribal variations in our manuscripts. And by variations, what we mean is that one copy of John, for example, would read one thing and then another copy of John in the same verse would have a different word or something like that.
Yeah.
Those are known as scribal variations. Now, there's thousands of these in the New Testament. And so textual criticism is the science by which we work our way back to what was originally written. Now, as soon as someone hears that and they believe in the inspiration of the Bible, typically they get thrown into a brief panic where they think, oh no, if that's true, then this must mean my Bible is not reliable. But that's not the case at all. What people need to realize is that what I just described is the way every single book in the entire ancient world works.
Hmm.
The Bible is the New Testament is not some odd case here. It's not at all scandalous to say that there's textual variance in our manuscripts. There's textual variance in every book in the ancient world.
Hmm.
In fact, the New Testament's in a very good position because we have so many copies of it that we can look and trace these manuscripts back and be very reliable we can very reliably restore what we think the original text was. So we're actually in a really good position as it pertains to the New Testament. But yes, those variations were there. And what critics love to do is to pounce on them and try to make you nervous about them.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, there's no reason to be. We can be very confident in our New Testament text.
And can you give, again, maybe just a few bullet point responses about how we can have confidence that the manuscripts are reliable, that the Bible that we're holding is reliable and goes back to the original? Like, what would be some bullet point responses to that?
Yeah, so the two data points that are worth noting on that score are the date of our manuscripts and the number of our manuscripts. And for anybody doing textual criticism, you want manuscripts as old as you can get them, as close to the events they're recording as the time of original publication as you can. And then secondly, you want a lot of them to see if there's been changes throughout regions and time.
Right.
And in the New Testament, we have both things fulfilled in really good situations. So we have a number of manuscripts of the New Testament from the 2nd century, which is really early. And people who aren't in the field can't appreciate this, but when you think about events that happened in the 1st century or books that were published, I should say, in the 1st century, it's not unusual to have our earliest copy 1,000 years later. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Josephus' work is this way. We know about Josephus, first century Jewish historian, his book Antiquities or Jewish War. In many instances, we don't have a reliable manuscript till the 10th century.
Hmm.
That's pretty normal. But that's not true for the New Testament. We have a number of copies of different parts of the New Testament in the 2nd century, as early as 125 of the 2nd century, in fact. So that tells you right there that you're dealing with a situation where we see the text at a very early stage. And so if someone says the text's been changed, we're like, well, we go back almost to the 1st century. So there's not a lot of time there to change the text, right? You just don't have a lot of time to do a wholesale textual revision that wouldn't be visible in the 2nd century. And then the number of manuscripts helps too. We have thousands and thousands of copies, and we can compare these and contrast these and see if there's any stability problems or so on. And again, the New Testament credentials are excellent in this way. So those are the two bullet points I think people need to know.
Yeah, that's good. That's great. All right, to land the plane here, I'm just curious, in terms of canon, is there a question that I should have asked you that I'm just not even smart enough to know what the question is? Something, I just basically want to hear your final thoughts on canon stuff while I still have you on the phone.
Yeah, wow, there's so many layers to this and so many aspects of this. I'm sure there's more questions out there than obviously the ones you've asked.
Yeah.
I'm not sure there's any that need to be brought up at this particular point. I think that people just need to realize that although we have these other books out there, the quality of these books and the reliability of these other books and the potential that they really are better than our New Testament books, it's just the chances of that are just very low. Hmm. We can see these books. We know what they are. We have a good sense of when they are written, and they just don't compare. And so I guess one thing I would leave with the listeners is that, and one thing we haven't fully talked about is that it's just a qualitative difference here. Mm. The New Testament books in every way outshine these apocryphal books, and people often don't know that because they haven't read the apocryphal books. And for that matter, a lot of people haven't even read the New Testament books. So, you know, they don't really know that when you compare something like the Gospel of Thomas to the four canonical Gospels, that you're dealing with something that sounds very different. And I think that's an important point to take away.
Yeah, that's good. And so if somebody wanted to do a deeper dive into these questions, what would be some resources you could point them towards?
Yeah, so I've developed a webpage that's been up for quite a number of years now that is designed to help people think about canon issues at a lay level. So certainly they can read a number of the books I've written, and there's of course other books out there that others have written that are helpful, but most of those are on the more academic side and they're not easy to get through. But if someone wants a sort of popular level quick take out there on canon, I'd point them to my website. So my website's called Canon Fodder, and that's canon with one N, right? Because it's the biblical canon, not the canon that where you light a canon
right
and fire a cannonball. Canon Fodder, and then it's just the URL is just my name, michaeljkruger.com. And on that site, there's videos, there's articles, there's blog series, there's all kinds of interviews and lectures. People can get sort of filled up on canon issues to their heart's content. But I want to mention one series in particular, and it's a series called the 10 Most Common Misconceptions About Canon. If they go to my website and look in the bottom left part of the main page, they'll see the list of the series I've done, and it's the 10 misconceptions about canon. I think if you just go through all 10, the folks will learn a ton of things that they may not have known, and I think those series have been real helpful for people.
Those are written articles? That particular series?
Those are written articles.
Okay. Well, that's great. Thank you.
It's a blog series, 10-part blog series.
10-part blog series. Maybe I could incorporate that into my 10-year, 10 hardest questions. There's a lot of 10s going on. We can figure out a way to do it.
Well, all of them, all the 10-part blog series is all related to canon. So top 10 misconceptions about canon. But I cover other issues on my website, too, that might get into your hardest questions.
And it's michaeljkruger.com?
Yep.
Okay. All right, do you want a bonus question? Do you want a final bonus question?
Sure, man. Fire away.
Bonus question is this. Is it true that Martin Luther didn't want James to be in the Bible, or he thought that should not have been included in the canon? And if he did, what's your response to old Luther?
So that's partially true. Luther was very critical of the book of James, and he questioned whether it bore the true teachings of Christianity. And the reason is because he didn't see enough gospel in James. It didn't have enough talk about the cross or justification by faith alone and so on.
Right.
So yes, Luther was critical of James. Did he kick it out of the Bible? Well, it's not that simple. And, you know, what Luther was known for in his early years was making a lot of very sort of controversial statements, many sort of overstated statements, and would be quite combative about a lot of things. And so Luther was known for making extreme comments all the time.
Yeah.
And if you track him in his later years, he tends to mellow a little bit on some of these.
Hmm.
And he did on James as well as other books that he was critical of.
Hmm.
So, yeah, you know, Luther kind of could fire off from the hip and say things that maybe later he wished he hadn't said. And
sure.
I guess we can all do that to some extent. But
yeah.
So that's partially true. But again, you know, Luther's view of James is quite the minority report. Obviously, the history of the church is not doesn't at all share his view.
Yeah, man, awesome. Well, Dr. Kruger, thank you so much for taking the time to talk through these issues. I'm sure it'll be helpful for people listening in, and I appreciate your scholarship and your work in this area, and for your willingness to talk about it and package it at a popular level. And scholastic.
Well, thanks, Matt. Yeah, happy to do it. Hopefully, it's helpful for folks. And you know, again, if they are if their curiosity's piqued, there's more to find on my website,
MichaelJKruger.com. Right?
Yep.
Bam.
That's it. Thanks.
Awesome. Hopefully, that was helpful for you guys. It was really helpful for me to be able to sit down and talk with Dr. Michael Kruger. Again, mega shout out for him for his willingness to take some time out of his day and talk about this stuff with little old me over here in my little old office. But I appreciate him, and just, you know, there's more to come. So you just got to wait for it. Like Hamilton, got to wait for it, Aaron Burr. So we'll see you next time. Peace!